Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Baptist Review Podcast. I'm your host, David Sons, and we continue today in our interviews of Southern Baptist Convention presidential candidates for this June in Indianapolis. And today I am joined by Pastor Clint Presley. Clint, thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us today on the podcast.
Thank you, sir. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're excited to talk all things SBC. I'm also joined by Andrew Hebert. Andrew is one of our leadership team at the Baptist Review. Andrew, thanks for your time today too, bud.
Dave, it's great to be with the best podcasting voice in the SBC.
Thanks, man.
You're talking about Clint.
Oh, well, that's unfortunate.
He was not.
I walked into that one. All right. Hey, Clint, obviously, Andrew and I have known you for a little while. We've been friends. I know that you're pretty well-known around the SBC to most folks, but I do want to begin our interview by just maybe giving the opportunity for you to share a little bit about your personal story, about the pastor, about the church that you pastor. And so maybe you'd start by just sharing a little bit about your testimony, about your call to ministry, and a little bit about the church that you serve now.
Yeah, thanks, man. Really, I appreciate you guys doing this and having me on. I was raised here in Charlotte in a Christian home, but we went to a Presbyterian church, PCUSA, a liberal Presbyterian church, and never really heard the gospel except maybe in the Apostles' Creed. So I had it memorized, but didn't know the gospel. When I was 11 years old, the church hired an intern for the summer, and he, at a summer camp, explained the gospel to me in a way I could understand it, that I was a sinner, a need for a savior, what Christ had done for me, his death and resurrection. If I put my faith in Christ alone, I'd be saved. Man, I did. I asked God to save me by faith in Jesus. My grandmother gave me a hardback Living Bible, which is kind of the Bible. Started reading it. And the guy told me that led me to Christ, said, look, you got to pray now and read the Bible. So I started reading the Bible and praying. By the time I was 15, we were visiting some friends in Virginia. And they're the kind of friends that make you go to church if you're staying over with them. We were there for the weekend, and we went to First Baptist Church, Roanoke, Virginia. The first Baptist church I ever set foot in. I was 15 years old, and I had never heard preaching like that. I mean, it was powerful. You know, guy had a book standing up there. He was yelling at us, sweating. And I already thought that's what I wanted to do, be a preacher. But that day I knew I wanted to be a Baptist preacher. So we came to Charlotte, came back home. We joined Hickory Grove when I was in the 11th grade. Here's where I learned discipleship, started learning, you know, all of the kind of layers of Southern Baptist, cooperative program, missions. Went off to college, Wofford College, played football there 4 years, and then went to Southwestern Seminary. It's where I met my wife, Southwestern. She graduated MDiv from Southwestern before I did. She's a couple years ahead of me. And I didn't want to be in school. I wanted to preach. And so I quit seminary. Me and Connie, we left Texas and moved to Mississippi. There was a church there that I had preached a couple times in. They were desperate, 30 people. And they hired me. I'd been married 6 weeks and started preaching. I was 23. I could live in the house. And they paid me $150 a week, and then I could do something else. You know, maybe drive a dump truck, and I coach football and substitute taught. And pretty soon, you know, you find out, okay, you want to preach. You don't know anything. I don't know. I mean, I love Jesus. I love the Bible. I love people. I didn't know how to get them all together. And so I started back to seminary in New Orleans. And it was 140 miles south of where we were living. And I'd drive down every morning. And drive back every afternoon. And so that's how I got my seminary degree. Served 2 churches in Mississippi. I came back to Hickory Grove because they knew me from being here. I was an intern in college. Came back, was on staff here from 99 to 04. Then I went to Dolphin Way. Dolphin Way been through a hard time. We went there in 04. I thought that's where I'd be. Man, I loved it there. I loved everything about Dolphin Way. And so we spent 6 years there. In 2010, the former pastor here, who was also the guy that baptized me, he's my pastor, was retiring and asked me to come back. The church did, to do a transition. And so I came back in 2010 at Hickory Grove and has been here ever since.
Wow. So this is your like third stint, really, third season of life at Hickory Grove. That's pretty unique.
I mean, yeah, it really is. I joined this church in 1985. you know, and then came back in 99 and then came back in 2010.
Wow.
Yeah.
You've been asked to be nominated for SBC president before. I know that because I've asked you before a number of years ago, and you've prayed about it from time to time. You've also nominated other men to be SBC president, but this is the first year that you've allowed yourself to be nominated. So my question is, why 2024? What's different about this year?
So I almost did it the year that that Ed, you know, he served a term and then wasn't going to serve a second. So I almost did it then. And then I'd heard that Willie Rice was going to do it, or that he was thinking about it. So I called him. He's like, well, if you're going to run, I don't want to run. And he's like, really feels like he needs to do it. I was like, all right, well, I'm not going to run against you, you know. So I withdrew before I even really announced. And he said, well, why don't you nominate me? Then, of course, all that happened. And so I thought about it then. And then after this summer, I was approached by different, you know, we all have kind of different segments of the SBC. And from a couple different quadrants of the SBC, I was called and said, are you thinking about that? Would you give thought? Hey, man, you need to run next year. So we started praying about it, me and Connie. And, you know, I love the convention. I feel like it's been in this weird sort of almost angry spot. And I'd love to be a part of seeing it cool some of that down. And turn our attention back to, you know, what we do so well when it comes to missions. So, I figured I would take a run at it.
Clint, all of those, you talked about, you know, a couple different sectors of the SBC, folks, all of those sectors are represented by different group text messages that where the real action occurs within the SBC. And so,
right.
Well, Clint, it's good for us. I think one of the things that we've tried to do is personalize these interviews a little bit to where I think sometimes in the run up to a presidential election, you guys can just be defined by the sum of your positions on specific things. And so I think it's important. Yeah. I think it's important for anybody who's voting in Indianapolis for president to get a little bit of the picture of the history and the man who's actually running for president. So we appreciate certainly you sharing a little bit about your story and testimony and about Hickory Grove and the churches you serve. But we do want to talk a little bit about specific issues, particularly a few issues that I know are going to be discussed and debated and decided upon in Indianapolis this year, and then will have implications for the SBC in the future. And one of those is around the issue of abuse reform. Obviously, sexual abuse reform has been a major piece of each of the last three SBC meetings, and really kind of going back to the Houston Chronicle article and then what was decided in Nashville in 2021 with the motion for the executive committee to waive attorney-client privilege and to have a third-party independent investigation. At the time, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but you were in favor of the executive committee waiving privilege and of the independent investigation into the executive committee's handling of reports of sexual abuse, which ultimately were published in the Guidepost report. Since then, the investigation and then the subsequent litigation as a result of that report, including a DOJ investigation, it's really been costly for the EC and the SBC. Which has led a lot of people, not a lot, but has led some to criticize others to maybe escrow cooperative program funds, or others have left the SBC entirely, generally kind of citing a concern that too much money has been spent to pay lawyers and settle lawsuits. And knowing what we know now, so 3 years later, would you still advocate for an independent third-party investigation in the manner in which it was done?
Man, that's a good question. I don't know. I really don't know. I'm not sure that I would, given the results of the investigation. You know, it's not like we found all of this that, you know, oh gosh, we've uncovered all this terrible, which is, of course, sexual abuse is terrible, but we didn't uncover what we thought. Like when I remember reading the report and thinking, oh, what stood out the most was what happened with Johnny Hunt. And so I'm not sure I would, because I really, in the beginning, I wasn't, some of it you didn't understand. Like you first hear, okay, we want to waive attorney, you know, client privilege. And you're thinking, yeah, open everything up. Because that is kind of what we do. We say, see everything, see it all. I think a lot of us, there are some of those unintended consequences seeing so much money that has been spent.
One of the things that I think has arisen in the last couple of weeks, perhaps, I know this was a part of a previous interview you did with other SBC presidents that Tom Askell hosted on Spaces a couple of weeks ago. There's been a little bit of some debate about whether or not it's fair to characterize abuse within the SBC as a crisis. That was a question that was asked to you in that Spaces interview with Tom. And your answer was, you stated sexual abuse is not a system-wide crisis, but it is a crisis. And I thought maybe you could kind of elaborate some on what you mean by that and how, you, maybe in your opinion, the convention should move forward in addressing abuse reforms.
Yeah, I think to when you hit it like this, say, is it a crisis or is it not? You pull out some of the way to talk about it. I think that for if this church had a case of sexual abuse, it's going to be an absolute, I mean, full on fire here at Hickory Grove. So we would put that in the category of crisis, that you want to run to it. The Christian impulse is to do all you can to make sure you put the fire out, help the people that are victims, and then prevent it from happening again. So to say it's a system-wide, I'm not willing to go that far. I think that what you have here are some really terrible things that have happened in local churches that are Southern Baptist, and by God's grace, we've got sense enough to try to do something to help those churches. And that's where I think that some of the good of the task force, I mean, honestly, you go to the website and the ministry toolkit. I mean, seriously, you think every church of every size can benefit from just follow the directions, just do that. Because previously, you know, we wouldn't know what to do. You wouldn't be sure as to, okay, I know I'm supposed to call the police, but what else do I do? And to have sort of a clear step-by-step approach when it comes to training, screening, and protecting, and then reporting, that's been very helpful. So some of what has happened has raised the awareness and then made churches, I think, see some of their glaring deficiencies that they just didn't know they had, that you just had not thought about previously. So 2019 forward has changed so much about how we would approach preventing and dealing with sexual abuse.
You feel like I say reward, I don't mean it in that. You feel like the good of that, what you said a moment ago, that churches are better prepared, that they understand how to prevent abuse better, that they understand how to care for survivors, that they understand these pieces. Like those things are good things that have come out, that churches are better prepared. Do you feel like those things could have happened apart from the third party investigation? Or do you feel like that those things are actually that had to happen in order to get us to the place that we're at now, where churches are in some sense better prepared to handle these issues?
I don't know if it could have happened with or without the investigation. I do think leading up to the investigation, I mean, when we hear all of the sexual abuse talk, what happens is it scares us to death. Mm. Like if you're a pastor, you're a church, I mean, you immediately think about your people, your church, what if, and, so I think that that started the process of, hey, we need to do something. Now, whether or not we would have gotten to where we are without the investigation, I don't know.
Yeah.
But the task force, to me, they've done a yeoman's work in just that, in getting us there so that any church can go and benefit completely. Like if every church would just do that, I mean, we are light years ahead of where we were in 2019.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Clint, I'd like to ask about something a little bit more recently. This has been all over the news, but several of our SBC entities participated in filing an amicus brief in the case of Samantha Killery in Kentucky. And since that time, Bart Barber, our current president, has said, you know, this is something that probably should not have been done. the executive committee, SBC executive committee, has formed a subcommittee of trustees to evaluate how the EC makes those kind of legal decisions going forward. So in other words, I think that's an implicit acknowledgement. Hey, this was a mistake and we need some kind of safeguard to make sure this kind of thing doesn't happen again. Dr. Moeller made a statement on behalf of Southern, just saying, you know, basically deferring to legal counsel at Southern. And then Lifeway hasn't said anything about it one way or the other. And I think a lot of survivor advocates, but really rank and file Southern Baptists look at this thing, scratching their heads and say, this seems to be going in the opposite direction of caring for abuse survivors. And I think as stunningly, a lot of us are just wondering why the radio silence on this thing? Why aren't our leaders publicly owning this and acknowledging and explaining what they've done? So I'm just curious what your take on is on all of that is. I know you're on the board at Southern and used to be chairman years ago. But as an SBC presidential candidate, what would you say to Southern Baptists who are wondering why was this done?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the why behind it is getting all of the advice from the lawyers and what you have to do to make sure you're going to win the case you're in, as I understand it, that the amicus brief was a terrible necessity and not a signal to say you're not caring for survivors.
Let me ask a follow up about that, because I think one of the things, you know, hearing your answer about the third party investigation, which just full cards on the table. I was part of the sexual abuse task force, the original task force that oversaw that investigation. We were not the investigators, but we were that go between the executive committee and guidepost to make sure that it happened. I think one of the things that was surprising to me when I read it, I'm kind of like you, Clint. When I saw it, there maybe wasn't as much of what I was expecting to see.
Yep.
But there were some cases that I think maybe the most egregious examples were cases where executive committee employees really mishandled certain reports of abuse on the council of lawyers. So talking to lawyers, what should we do? How should we respond? And the attorneys giving them advice to protect against liability.
Yeah.
Really gave them bad advice, and they went with what the lawyer said. And so, I mean, I'm thinking now about the amicus brief, and I'm thinking, okay, you're listening to the attorneys once again, trying to protect our legal interests, but maybe at the expense of a victim of sexual abuse. Mm. How would you navigate that? I know I'm asking a hypothetical here, but as SBC president, you're going to be hearing from lawyers, from SBC lawyers,
whose
interests are to protect us legally. But at the same time, we have a responsibility to protect survivors and do what is just. And so just talk through, how do you navigate that? How would you navigate that as SBC president?
Yeah, it really is. You know, it's one of those dilemmas you get put in, because as the president of the convention, how much authority do you really have to even do those things? You know what I'm saying? You can provide influence and talk to, but you don't necessarily have the authority to do any of that. I mean, I think that Bart would even admit that's outside of his ability to guide. He can speak to it. He can't make the decision.
Yeah, and I think he wrote about that and just basically said, I'm not sure I even had the authority
to sign that thing. Yeah.
So would you, but you do have the bully pulpit. So how would you wield the power of the bully pulpit to sometimes tell the lawyers, okay, this might make the most legal sense to protect us in court, but it's maybe not what is most just.
Yeah. And I think that's what you would do, is press against those two hard issues, is you want to do what is just and then what is necessary. And it sounds to me, as I understand it, depending on who's explaining the amicus brief, depending on who's explaining it, one side says we had to do this. Another side will say they did not have to do that. It was not necessary for their case. I've heard both. It's probably going to depend on who you talk to, how to answer that. I mean, it really is, to me, a very thorny thing.
You know, Clint, I want to pivot kind of from abuse reform into another major issue that will be probably dominate a lot of the press and a lot of the work that goes into the annual meeting this year, and that is the law amendment. I know that this is something, just for background, I don't have to tell you this or Andrew this, but just for background, the law amendment was passed last year in its first vote in New Orleans and will be voted on to be ratified this year in Indianapolis. And I know that you're on record as in favor of the law amendment. You were actually one of the early signees of Mike Law's petition to have the EC take up the matter last year. And so the vote for president will not really impact the vote of law amendment, right? And so regardless of...
It's so weird that that becomes the issue and it doesn't even...
Yeah, so you'll just vote, whether or not you become the next president of the SBC, you'll vote for that amendment, you know, really as just a messenger from Hickory Grove Baptist Church. However, if you are voted president of the SBC by the messengers, that could have major implications on the way that you lead and certainly will for the future of the SBC. And so I'll just ask this, you're in favor, and I think we've got two candidates, two of the five that are opposed and three that are in favor. And so I've tried to ask the question this way. If voted president, your term begins after the vote is taken. How would you lead and engage our convention if the amendment fails? So let's say it fails, and then you're the president, you've been in favor, and how do you now kind of seek to lead and engage our convention after it fails?
I wouldn't do any differently than if it passed. It passed. I when the law amendment came out, Mike Law sent it to me. We had just done something at Southern by way of resolution that sounded just like the law amendment. So I'm like, yeah, that's exactly, yeah, that's what we believe. I think it's a good thing. And so then, of course, it started picking up steam, everybody signing it. And all of the discussion, I don't think that it is, the discussion is those who affirm the law amendment are full-throated complementarians and those that do not are egalitarians. I think that's an unfair characterization. I think more than likely that most of us Southern Baptists are standing real close together. We're mobbed on a border between states. And while I might be standing in North Carolina, I'm so close to the border, if you're in South Carolina, that we actually are not that far apart. We just happen to be in two different states.
We're at Carowinds is what you're saying?
At Carowinds is what I'm trying to tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that's probably where most of us are, that there are some who say, yeah, this makes, like, I'm on the side that says, it's plain, it makes sense, it'll be clear, it'll help us. There are others who would be theologically the same as me that are saying, you know what, this is actually not going to be very good for us. I have constitutional issues with it, or it's going to be detrimental for some of our churches that are some of our ethnic churches, that sort of thing. I don't think that comes from a theological basis. I think it's a procedural. So to answer your question, I don't think I would lead any differently, whether it passes or not.
Clint, I've really appreciated the way that you have voiced your support of the law amendment, but at the same time being gracious in your interactions, your engagements with those who disagree with you. And one of those people is me. And just for context, for the people who are listening may not know this, but Clint and I are friends and have been for years, and you've preached for me, and you know I love and appreciate your ministry, but we do disagree on this one. And so I've just appreciated personally the way you've conducted yourself, just with Christ-like graciousness.
I appreciate that, man. Thank you.
And interacting with those who aren't on the same page. If the law amendment does pass, I think there is a group in the convention that look at the, I think it was a website that was published a few months ago that had a list of all the churches, church names, church staff members, somebody had culled. It might have been, I don't remember, I don't want to say who it was because I don't remember who it was. He had kind of gone through a bunch of church websites and culled the list and had a list of specific staff members. I think there are a good group of Southern Baptists who are concerned that if the law amendment passes, that's kind of going to give some people license to start heresy hunting, if you will, searching church websites.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Churches
go
over to the credentials committee. So how would you speak to that? Would you speak to those who may be concerned about it? And then if there's somebody listening and maybe they're somebody who might start looking at church websites to try to turn people to the credential committee, what would be your counsel to all on the spectrum in that regard?
Yeah, I don't have any interest in doing that. And I think anybody that does is not busy enough in the church work that they do. And truthfully, if you've got a group of folks like they actually could do that right now. I mean, to speak to someone like yourself who affirms the Baptist faith, the message, it actually is clear enough. You could just use it. If you wanted to be on a witch hunt, you can get on one this morning. You've got enough documentation for that.
Okay, let me ask a follow-up then, because that's an interesting one. I think you've just made an argument that a lot of people make, which is we do have enough documentation currently. Baptist Faith and Message 2000, we've already seen it with Saddleback. We've got enough to be able to expel churches over this. So why do we need the law amendment?
Yeah, the only thing I would say is that in 2022, it showed up as an issue when the Credentials Committee couldn't. I don't know if you remember kind of the fumbling of all of that on the floor with deciding on what a pastor is. They were then going to create a committee to go back and study that and come back to the convention. And then in 2023, the whole process, there was such debate that it seems to me that the law amendment would just give clarity. It would give the Credentials Committee a means by which to understand the BFNM and take some of the subjectivity out. That would be one of the reasons that I would vote for it.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Let me pivot us to a different topic. Another big issue that I think people are going to be considering during the SBC this year is that of financial transparency. And so a motion that was referred to the executive committee that might come before the messengers this year involves financial disclosures from our entities. And so the two motions requiring entities to disclose information equivalent to the, what's been the IRS form 990 for nonprofits. Proponents of that motion say, look, this is about financial transparency that our entities should be held to at least the same standard as secular nonprofits. You know, why aren't we doing this? And they basically saying every Southern Baptist Church has the right to know how all of our CP dollars are spent.
Yeah.
Opponents of the motion say that, you know, public disclosures to that level could damage our entity's ability to protect sensitive employee information. It could undermine the trustee system. It could put at risk certain religious protections that have been offered to us by the federal government. And opponents say that much of the information requested is already disclosed to the convention when you read your entity annual reports. We get quite a bit of financial information printed there. So, Clint, you publicly voiced, I think, some opposition to that effort for that 990 piece, saying that that's why we have trustees. We've got trustees.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, could it not also be argued that it would help trustees be more accountable by making the messengers who appoint our trustees more aware of the financial situations in our entity? So if I can voice it the way I think I've seen it on social media, you know, you trust the trustees, yes, but do the trustees trust Southern Baptists? I think that's the way I've seen it put.
Yeah.
How would you respond to that?
So I think that's a different question than the transparency question.
Okay.
Or maybe at least related. The transparency question is, the answer would be, yes, we are all for transparency. We believe in transparency. We think that is the right way to be. It's why we have things set up like they are. It's part of the business financial plan of the SBC. It is in the Book of Reports. It is given every year. It's why we have the trustees. It's why we put our schools into accreditation. It's why that they're audited every year. All of those things are laid out. Really what it gets down to, it sounds like to me, is at the end of it is wanting to know the top salaries. It seems like that's what is driving some of this. Because most of the information is readily available. Maybe it's not dispersed well. And there may be a better way to have it, you know, more readable. But most of the information that you would find on a 990, you can find right now. I think some of this comes out of, you know, we're serving churches, and oftentimes in churches, the pastor's salary is shown to everybody there. Mm-hmm. You see it. And I actually served two churches just like that. I've also served two churches that were not like that, the churches would provide a modicum of privacy for the pastor. And you have several pastors on staff, those salaries with all the other salaries are lumped into one sum. That doesn't mean they're not being transparent, because you certainly have people that are members of the church that are part of the finance committee or professional personnel committee that have eyes on that. And they are elected by the church to do that. And it gives at least some modicum of privacy. So to say you wouldn't be for transparency is not really true. I would be for that transparency. And if the messengers press it to the very edge of we want to see everything that everybody's making, then we'll end up doing that. But there is some, at least, I don't know if it's a luxury or just a kindness to having some of that held privately and yet having Southern Baptist eyes on it by way of trustees that see it.
Yeah,
Clint, that's the system we have. And there are some holes that have popped up here and there. But if you think about all of our entities over the course of time, it's actually worked pretty good.
Clint, I appreciate that you said that, because I've heard that same kind of sentiment elsewhere that, hey, you know, this we're talking about financial transparency, but really it may be about more, but it's certainly not about less than entity executive salaries, knowing what entity executives make. And I know you and I, you know, I've talked to another candidate about this earlier. I know you and I have been in church long enough that you know that in some churches, any pastor that makes more than some church member makes too much. I think what you kind of hit on is saying, hey, let's make sure that, you know, we're for transparency, but transparency doesn't always mean that everybody has all, you know, everybody has all of this information presented to them. In some sense, we have to kind of trust the trustees, the people that we've put in position to make some of these decisions and hold some of this information, not for nefarious purposes, but for reasonable purposes. And so I want to build on this question, because I think you said this in a previous interview, and I think you alluded to it here. Is the trustee system a part of the problem? And are in your opinion, are calls for transparency really expressions of distrust in trustee boards or entity executives?
I think that it's a distrust in almost everything. I think that we've seen that all across the board when it comes to, you know, even with the sexual abuse, there's just a sense of we can't trust.
Yeah.
And so that is not a great way to operate.
No.
It may be that to rebuild it, we just have to open up every single thing that there is. It may come to that. It may come to that. It's not a great way to move forward, though. We've got to find a way to build trust back into the system that we have, because it is the system we have. And if the system itself is broken, then yeah, let's change the system. But the way it stands, this is what we have.
Yeah. And that was my kind of follow-up question to you, is if it is about this, and I think you're right. I think that some of this, again, I don't want to say that's all. I do think in some sense, this is a symptom of a greater issue, that there is just a high level of distrust right now among the SBC. So you would say, hey, listen, if we've got to open up everything to rebuild that trust, and maybe that's what we have to do. But I don't think that what you're saying is, hey, that's not necessarily something that I would say that's the first option. And so as president, if you're elected president and you come in and you recognize, man, there is just a trust deficit, how do you go about repairing that kind of deficit?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not really sure. I'd like to see where all of that is and how much of it is me thinking there is, and how much of it is actually there is, and what can a president actually do besides what we've already said is the bullet pulpit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, am I going to appoint another task force? It seems like even that has lost any trustworthiness. You know what I mean? People are tired of that. So I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Hey, Clint, we've got a couple other things we want to talk to you about, but we're going to take a quick break. Hey, I just want to take a minute to say something about our sponsor for this episode. The North American Mission Board has been putting out some new podcasts that I'm pretty sure if you're a pastor or a church leader, you're going to find really helpful. Trevin Wax has been doing this documentary-style podcast called Reconstructing Faith. They're two seasons out right now. It's super engaging. Trevin is looking at the major challenges facing the church right now. Everything from the anti-institutional ethos of our culture to the phenomenon of dechurching, debates over masculinity, the prevalence of pornography, spiritual burnout, and on and on and on. You can listen to the Reconstructing Faith podcast on whatever podcast platform you prefer, and I'd encourage you to check it out. You know, life is full of special moments and big decisions. And one of the biggest decisions that you or your family can make is the choice to adopt. And if you're thinking about adopting or wanting to adopt, I want to talk to you about one of our partners and sponsors, Lifeline Children's Services. Lifeline believes that adoption is a divine calling. It's a way that God provides families for vulnerable children who deserve love and a sense of belonging. Lifeline works to be relational, building connections with families, partners, and local churches. They're also gospel-centered. They put the love of Christ at the heart of everything that they do. And if you're considering adopting, Lifeline promises to walk with you before, during, and after your adoption. Lifeline Children's Services adoption program answers the call to share love and build families because every child deserves a home. You can visit lifelinechild.org/adoption today to learn more and begin your adoption journey. You know, Clint, next year is the 100th anniversary of the cooperative program, and the CP has had a really strong start to the year. Baptist Press reported that January of this year actually saw the highest monthly cooperative program total, a little bit more than $19 million that we've seen in 2 years. And certainly I know that over the past couple of years, we've seen some decline in CP giving and different various reasons. But one of the roles of the SBC president is to help protect and promote the cooperative program. And so as president, how would you attempt to do that?
I think you can turn all your attention toward it. I mean, I think that's what makes us Southern Baptist, actually. Since we're not a denomination, what are we? Well, we cooperate, we're connected, and it's the cooperative program that really becomes sort of the avenues of by which we are connected. Whether it's on an associational level, state level, or, you know, national. That's what, I mean, that's how I learned what it is to be a Southern Baptist. When I was 23 years old, pastor of a church in Lincoln County, Mississippi, went to the associational building, and there are 29 other pastors in that county. And that's who taught me what actually Southern Baptist life is. Mm. And so from that level, I think you're seeing a little bit of a resurgence in some of the states. Like Georgia's baptisms are up. I know here in North Carolina, we baptized like 41% more than we did last year.
Yeah, there were great statistics coming out of North Carolina this past week. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so all across the board, I think you're seeing some of this, a little bit more of that coming back together. I don't know what to make of that, except to say it's a good thing. That is what makes us Southern Baptist. So it would not be hard to promote the cooperative program if you actually are Southern Baptist and believe in it.
Clint, there seems to be so many fracture points in our convention, you know, just a lot of tribalism and that kind of thing. And, you know, I think probably since Resolution 9 in Birmingham 2019, you know, accusations of CRT and wokeness.
Oh, man.
Liberal drift and that kind of thing. I think at one point, you know, this was, I think, in the craziness of 2020, I think I even saw accusations of liberal theology at Southern Seminary and with Dr. Mueller.
Right.
And it's disorienting. You know, it's a disorienting thing to watch those kind of accusations fly around. So I'm just curious, as you hear that, when you hear accusations of liberal drift or that our entity leaders are bowing to a culture of wokeness, or any of those kinds of accusations, do you think there's truth to that? Is the SBC sliding leftward?
I think that is too general of a statement. When I announced that I was going to run, I somehow got put in somebody put me in a woke camp for something. I don't know what. But I thought, Lord, have mercy. I mean, the guys here call me Ron Swanson. How can I be woke? So I think that there is some significant overstatement to some of that. I don't deny that that there are some legitimate concerns that we need to have, as evidenced by our conversation on women pastors. I think that's one issue. But to put a blanket statement over the SBC that it has gone liberal, I think that is quite an overstatement. Mm.
Yeah, you know, just as a local church pastor, when church members will read articles or see something on social media or ask me about it, I just say, look, you know, 13 million Southern Baptists, are there liberal Southern Baptists? Absolutely. That many number of people, there are going to be people who say something that's leftward leaning or what have you. But But I'm with you on that one. Another question.
I would like to say that I think it's wise for us to continue to mark those things out that we do hold dear, the faith once and for all delivered to the saints, to not forget the battle for inerrancy and infallibility, to continue to reteach that. I think that's part of some of the issues that we've had with cooperative program is not actually stressing that, showing the good and talking about that. And we don't want to lose some of the, you know, some of the hard fought boundaries that were put up. I think we continue to reiterate that.
Yeah. Because we could be vulnerable to leftward drift at any point.
Right, sure. If you don't teach inerrancy over and over again and love it, it pretty soon is forgotten.
That's right. Without intention, there's drift. And so there has to be some intention there.
Yeah.
That's a good word. Clint, you're currently a council member of CBMW. That's, for those who may not know, that's the Council of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. And that's an organization that's been around for a long time, exists to promote, you know, complementarianism in the home and at church. And a lot of Southern Baptists are involved in that. But CBMW is housed, I think it's still housed at Southern Seminary.
It's not.
Not anymore. Oh, okay. Hey, breaking news right here. That's helpful. But you've been involved, and some of the SBC have criticized CBMW for promoting a more narrow approach to complementarianism than the SBC as a convention would adhere to. So if you're elected, does your involvement with CBMW change in any way? And if not, how do those two intersect, if at all?
But I'm sure it doesn't change in any way. My involvement now is on the council, and now and then we'll give them something by way of an article or a statement or whatever. How does it change? How does me becoming the president change that?
Yeah, does it change your involvement with CBMW at all? I mean, in other words, president of all Southern Baptists, right? So how does that, what do you say to the Southern Baptists who are maybe concerned about your involvement with that group?
I would say they can call and talk to me about it if they'd like. I mean, it you know, if you look at who's on the council besides me, there's some pretty solid guys that, you know, we listen to preach, that are in our seminaries, that are preaching in chapel. I would say there shouldn't be much of a concern there.
We'll be putting Clint's cell phone number.
We'll attach. That's right. We'll attach it in the show notes. You can find Clint's cell phone number and home address. No, just kidding. Yeah. Clint, I do kind of want to wrap up here and move towards kind of some just kind of general interest questions with you. I think one of the things you tweeted recently, I think it was actually in response to an article that we published, the Baptist Review, about Sam Rainer, by Sam Rainer. Your tweet I thought was good, where you said, "Hey, I wouldn't run for SBC president if I didn't think there was hope. The vast majority of pastors and lay people love the gospel, hate abuse, believe in inerrancy, want a male-only clergy, and are ready to get to the mission. I don't deny we have problems. I just deny hopelessness." In a time that seems pretty divided, where I do think there are Southern Baptists who look at the landscape and say, man, is this thing, like, are we just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic here?
Yeah.
How do you as president, you know, and really just you as not even as president, but really just as a pastor, how do you try to infuse our convention of churches with some hopefulness in a divided season?
Yeah, I think you start pointing at those things we do great. I mean, our house needs cleaning. It's true. But we got a really nice house. I mean, you don't want to destroy the house. The house is great. Just clean it. And so we'll deal with some of those issues we got to deal with. But, man, I mean, I think about the time when I first went to the Southern Baptist Convention. Very first time as a Southern Baptist preacher. Never been there. 24 or 5 years old. And you know, they used to walk in with those flags, the missionaries holding the flags of the countries that they were going. It's like, these are the people we're sending. And the sense of, that's what I'm a part of. That's what I'm doing. I think we have we've forgotten the actual value in celebrating some of those great things that we do. I'm not denying we have issues. We got that. But, man, we just really have, in the fog of trying to deal with these other things, we've forgotten there are some unbelievably good things that we do. I think as a president, part of the president's job, in my estimation, and it's what Andrew said, is the bully pulpit is to point people to those great things that we actually do without diminishing some of the work we have to do, you know, that need to continue going on. But I'm pointing to those good things.
Clint, we've got five candidates for SBC president at this moment. So this is not going to be a coronation for anybody, which is probably a healthy thing. But do you think that maybe reflects the fact that we've got five candidates? Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing? And what does that say about where we're at as a convention right now that we got five?
Yeah, I think that's actually a pretty good illustration of the kind of fractured nature. You know, we don't have two candidates. You don't have one that is left, one that is right. You don't have one that's a Calvinist, one that's not. I mean, you got five guys, and I think you probably could maybe reflect some of just the fractured nature of the whole thing. If I had to draw it out, I think I could probably start with one candidate and work through and tell you where those fractures are.
Do you know any of the other guys who are running?
I know Bruce. He's here in North Carolina. I don't know Mike, except to speak to. When he came out, I sent him a note, said, "Hey, man, pray for your family." I know David, a couple conferences. I know Jared. I just met him once, but I don't really know him very well.
I wonder if you would I know you maybe don't know all of those guys well, just based on what you just said, but I think the last few years SBC presidential elections have been somewhat contentious.
Yeah.
And a little bit of an us versus them feel to it. I wonder if it would help, you know, maybe just lower the temperature a little bit, having five and maybe particularly even give you an opportunity right now to just say something positive about the other guys. Is there anything you know about those other men that you would just say to Southern Baptists, "Hey, this is a guy who loves the Lord," or "the guy, you know, I'm friends with," or what could you say about?
Man, I can say that about all those guys, truthfully. And you know, before Bruce got in, I was on a text thread with all of them, getting ready for Askel's Twitter space, and everyone very respectful. You know, all would say, "Love the Lord, love the gospel, love the SBC." Each coming from just a little bit different of a perspective, but there seemed to be a pretty high level of respect. Like there wasn't any weird rancor. And I don't anticipate you hearing any of that from any of the candidates. I really don't. I mean, all along the way, everyone's been very respectful and seemed to be very kind. Each person has spoken well of the other, and I could go through and say, you know, something good about each guy and the job that they're doing where they are. So I don't think we're going to see that. I know what you're talking about with the rancor in the past, and I really don't get that sense. I think you're right in that there's so many of us now that there's not a one giant side against another giant side. And there's enough nuance between that and enough overlap between the candidates that, you know, we do have a good bit in common.
gave, Clint. I do think it does. It changes a little bit because it's not as, when you've got five candidates versus two candidates, there is going to be a difference, and it's not going to be a coronation, as Andrew said. Nobody's going to probably run away with this. So there's going to be different pieces of it.
I have no idea how that's going to play out, honestly.
Yeah. And it could be a really good thing. And I think even you guys, you know, as the candidates now, in the way that you interact with one another and the way that you, disagree strongly on specific positions, but do so in a way that is Christ-like and kind. I think that goes a long way to doing what you said, kind of turning the temperature down in the room. But
that's
ultimately
sort of what me and Connie had decided, you know, my wife and I, that as I prayed about it, I was like, you know, Connie, I don't want to just try to win and it'd be a bait and switch. And then people are like, well, that's not really what he said before. Mm. So I'm going to try to be as forthright. You know, this is who I am. This is what I believe. This is how I talk. And if that's what you want, vote me. If not, I certainly understand. I got a job to do here at Dickey Road.
Well, Clint, nobody that knows you is going to accuse you of not being direct. It's one of the things that we appreciate about you. You know, like you said, just I think your honesty, you kind of are who you are in front and behind. And so I'll close with this question, Clint, and just give you kind of the opportunity, maybe just to talk a little bit about kind of your hopes for this. And ultimately, one of the five of you will be nominated president. And let's say that in God's sovereignty and by the will of the messengers, it's you. And in June, you become the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. How do you maybe hope that the SBC is different at the end of your term? Or maybe I'll ask it this way. What are you hoping to accomplish by your presidency? I know certainly there are things that you would say, hey, no, we don't want this to be different. We love the way that this is, but there are things that do need to change. How do you hope that the SBC would be different at the end of a term?
Yeah, I hope that we can be more joyful on kind of the two areas of devotion and doctrine. Like, I hope we can be more, you know, glad of what it is we believe and stand by it, but also turning that doctrine into the real devotion of missions and strengthening some of the connectivity. I don't want unity for unity's sake, but I would like to see us unified and really joyfully unified around what we believe and then the mission that is born out of that. I think that moving away from that, those two things, connecting sort of our doctrine to our mission, is a mistake. And so I hope that, you know, if I were to be elected, that there would be a raised kind of not pride in it, but a raised love for what we do as Southern Baptists. Mm.
Well, Clint, we certainly are praying for you and for Connie and for Hickory Grove as you have undertaken this and certainly have been called to it and have been nominated for it now. And we'll be praying for you. I know in the next couple of weeks and months as you prepare to come to Indianapolis in June. And I just want to say thank you for your time. Thanks for your candor and just honesty and answering all the questions that Andrew and I had for you today. I know.
Man, I appreciate that, guys.
Yeah, I know it's going to go a long way to helping folks make a decision in Indianapolis. So, Clint, we appreciate you, buddy. Thanks for your time.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Baptist Review Podcast. The Baptist Review is committed to helping facilitate better conversation towards a better convention. For more information about the Baptist Review, you can check out our website, thebaptistreview.com.